Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 13, Derivatives Update. Thomas D'Ambrosio, Mike Phillip, and Akshay Balani will review a variety of developments impacting derivatives. Now, on to the podcast.
Margin is one of the pillars of Dodd-Frank derivative reform, and it was the last shoe to drop, so to speak, in the major rules that came out of the commissions, well, the CFTC and the prudential regulators in the case of margin, but it was one of the last rules to drop, and it's what affects the pricing of these transactions. But it's also what Congress thought would be very important in insulating dealers from shocks, from failures of other dealers, because if you have collateral, everybody is AAA, or at least that's the thought. So before Dodd-Frank, margin was set by contract. Now it's set by regulation, but only with respect to certain parties. The important timelines for us to keep in mind is that on March 1st of 2017, the variation margin rules came into effect. And there was a great scurry in February to try to comply with that March 1st deadline. And what the variation margin rules require, that requires the dealers to collect and post variation margin, that's mark-to-market margin based on the change in price of the derivative, on a daily basis in a limited number of collateral types to the counterparty. But not all counterparties are included. So when a dealer is entering into a transaction with another dealer, that transaction would be included. And when a dealer is entering into a transaction with a financial end user, that would be included. Financial end user includes hedge funds. So that's important for this constituency. So hedge funds are swept up in the variation margin rules if they apply. The variation margin rules do not apply to commercial end users. So in order to achieve compliance with the regulation, the documentation has to change. So to the extent that hedge funds are using derivatives, they need to make sure that their documents now reflect the appropriate rules. And so what hedge funds no doubt have seen prior to March 1st, or if that deadline was not met, the dealers are operating under no action relief in various jurisdictions now and have till September 1st to get the project done. But your dealer counterparties will undoubtedly be sending you or have already sent to you various types of amendments and new documents pursuant to which the fund would collateralize the derivative trades with the dealer. And what we experienced in February was a mad rush to get this done by March 1st. That did not occur for many parties. It occurred for some parties, but did not occur for many parties. And then the rush sort of tailed off a little bit. And now there will be a great push towards the end of the summer to get it all done by September 1st. According to ISDA, which is the governing body for derivatives, about 75%, maybe 77% of the full universe of counterparties that need documentation changes to address variation margin have satisfied that requirement. So we have another 25% of the market to go. And if you don't have these documents in place, you will find that the dealers are going to get more and more insistent. There'll be less room to negotiate those documents. And ultimately, the threat will be that if by September 1st those documents are not in place, trading will cease. So that's the important deadline to remember. There are other deadlines in September 1st of 2018 and 2019, 2020, dealing with initial margin. Initial margin is the upfront collateral that needs to be posted. That affects a small segment of the market, generally the biggest players, but it does not include all the players. The important thing to remember about margin is that when variation margin is collected, it has to be posted on a same-day basis. This presents problems for many firms that are in non-U.S. jurisdictions because of the need to transfer collateral through time zones. And if initial margin should apply to you, the challenge there is to get a separate custodian because the dealer is no longer allowed to hold the initial margin that's posted as collateral. The materials contain various haircuts for the margin that apply and the types of margin that are applicable. And I'll leave that to you, but for now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Mike Phillip, to talk about the enforcement issues.
Thank you, Tom. So I'm going to talk about recent developments and trends in futures exchange trade practice enforcement, and also about a new NFA reporting requirement that's going to kick in for registered CPOs and CTAs at the end of this month. We've noticed a marked increase in the number of enforcement actions being brought by futures exchanges, as well as in the fining that's been, the sanctions that have been imposed. In part, this reflects a dictate from the CFTC, who is trying to delegate more enforcement down to the SRO level at the NFA and the exchanges in order to conserve resources, enforcement resources at the CFTC for the big headline cases. But in any event, you might assume that if you are not a member of an exchange, that the exchange cannot have jurisdiction to bring an enforcement action against you. That would be a wrong assumption. Under the CFTC rules and under the exchange rules, if you initiate a transaction or execute a transaction on an exchange, even if you are not a member, you are subject to the enforcement jurisdiction of the exchange. And that includes not only agreeing to be bound by the rules of the exchange, but also producing records of asks, producing employees for interview, and cooperating with the investigation. And there have been a number of cases where certain parties have refused to cooperate, and they've wound up being sanctioned and being barred from the market for not producing records or cooperating with investigations. Unlike the CFTC, if the CFTC issues you a subpoena and asks that you produce records or produce people, there's a third, a judge has issued that subpoena, and you can go in and argue with get a third party independent forum to tailor the subpoena. In the case of the NFA and the exchanges, they do not, as a matter of right, recognize attorney-client privilege. They do not recognize privacy laws. They do not recognize redaction for relevance as a matter of right. You can negotiate it with them, but it's very different than having a third-party adjudicator deciding those issues. In addition, another trend that we've seen at the exchanges is that they are seeking to apportion liability not just to firms, to trading firms, to hedge funds, but also to the individuals that they believe are responsible for the activity. And the way the exchanges are getting at that is they are requiring all participants on exchanges to assign individual user IDs to every participant and to teams who work on automated trading systems. And so they're able to tell who did what, and so apportion liability to individuals as well. Another element of that, though, is that the firms or employers of the firms, the market participants, are held strictly liable for the activities of their employees, of their agents, and officers. And the exchanges have explained that by agents, they include automated trading systems. So if you have a piece of software that you've tested, that you've put risk controls on, but somehow due to some unexpected event, it malfunctions and causes a disruption on the exchange, the firm that employed that software will be held strictly liable for the malfunction of the software. And even though you had good or reasonable testing protocols, that might mitigate the amount of fine, but it will not serve as a defense to the underlying problem with the software. I want to move for a moment to a particular type of trading infractions that the exchanges have been focusing on quite a bit. As a general rule, all futures transactions are supposed to be executed competitively in the open auction market that the exchange has. There are two important exceptions for that, for EFPs and for block trades. A block trade is essentially a privately negotiated transaction between two parties that doesn't take place in the central marketplace. And because these are exceptions from the general rule, in order to avail yourself of them, you have to comply with very specific and technical requirements. So for example, in order to avail yourself of the ability to do a block trade. So for example, for block trades, there are requirements about qualification requirements as who can participate in a block trade. There are requirements that parties to the block trade must specifically authorize each order for a block trade as a block trade. There are minimum quantity sizes to be satisfied for a block trade. The price, there are parameters around pricing being fair and reasonable. There are reporting requirements that specify within how much time a block trade has to be reported to the exchange for dissemination. And also of great focus recently is the fact that there are now exchange prohibitions or restrictions on the dissemination of material non-public information related to block trades. And so information regarding a block trade, the exchanges have said, does constitute proprietary non-public information until such time as the block trade has been reported to the exchange. And so these block trade requirements have been of significant focus by exchanges recently. The ICE exchange recently sanctioned a Canadian trading firm for receiving from its broker material non-public information about some other broker client's pending block trade and then trading on that information that was wrongfully provided to it by the broker. The firm that traded on the information was fined $225,000 and was suspended from exchange access for 30 days. Another example of what could have been viewed perhaps as a technical violation, but it was taken seriously, is that ICE also fined a prop trading firm $100,000 for giving its broker a verbal standing instruction that it's okay to execute block trades for us rather than individually authorizing each block trade order. And then a number of firms have been fined, you know, $15,000, $50,000 in some cases for failure to report their block trades within the mandatory time, which is anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes after the block trade has been agreed upon, depending on what type of product. So, you know, the takeaway there is you need to have a good written policies and procedures and for traders who are going to be engaging in these sorts of exceptions from the central limit order book open auction rules. Just want to leave with, before turning it over to Akshay, one, remind you all that at the end of this month, NFA forms PQR for CPOs and PR for CTAs will require CPOs and CTAs to report two new financial ratios. One is a current asset to current liability ratio of the CPO or CTA, and that's intended to measure a CPO or CTA's liquidity. And the other ratio that they will have to report is a CPO's total revenues divided by total expenses for the previous year, and that's intended to measure its operating margin. This is instead of what the NFA had originally proposed to do, is to impose minimum regulatory capital requirements on CPO CTAs. There was significant pushback from the industry, and instead, this is kind of an interim step that will allow the NFA to monitor the financial status of CPO CTAs. And with that, I'll turn it over to Akshay.
Thanks, Mike. It's actually a really good segue into what I was going to talk about, and I didn't even know you were going to have this slide up here. So my goal is to tell you a little bit about what's going on at the CFTC and as far as recent developments and initiatives. So the reason I'm focusing on this slide is one of the newest developments or one of the newest initiatives at the CFTC, if you spend time on the CFTC site like I do, is to see what's going on, right, and you get updates. And so recently, one of their updates has been this new Project KISS. Now, I don't know if anybody knows what that means. I certainly didn't know what the acronym stands for, but in fact, it stands for Keep It Simple, Stupid. Okay, so when you look at a rule like, you know, these requirements that Mike just talked about, you know, they can be interpreted in different ways. You know, in fact, we get questions all the time on CFTC rules and what the interpretation is and how am I supposed to answer this question. And so perhaps they're going in the right direction here. You know, maybe we should keep it simple. So that was May 3rd, 2017, the CFTC voted to seek, in fact, public input on simplifying and modernizing their rules. you know, one of the things that as practitioners in this space, we get these questions all the time, and it can, you know, and clients get very frustrated. Like, I can't understand what's going on. Why are there three different definitions of U.S. person to think about? So clearly, these rules do need simplification and modification. I think as Chris Cox said at the lunchtime presentation, one of the tenets of the Financial Choice Act is that, in fact, to cause the SEC and the CFTC under Section 871 thereof to harmonize their own rules, which, by the way, was part of the mandate in 2010 when Dodd-Frank was originally passed. So, you know, if you've been following these rules and the promulgation of these rules from the SEC and the CFTC, primarily on the CFTC side, in fact, the SEC hasn't done too much yet, you'll see that, in fact, there isn't too much harmonization, not as between even agencies, but within the CFTC's rules themselves. So, as noted on the slide, the CFTC has put out basically this Project KISS, which is asking for public comment on four areas, which are registration, reporting, clearing, and executing. And it's to seek public comment on, and miscellaneous for something that's not covered above, as noted here, to seek public comment on how to streamline and modernize these rules. In preparation for this, I looked into what's going on in Project KISS, and in fact, there's not much. So there's been, as of yesterday anyway, a total of 5 comments received in these areas. One was a complaint that said, hey, nobody knows about this. You guys should get a Twitter account. So maybe the CFTC needs to modernize that aspect of its operations. Keeping in mind that the comment period for Project KISS ends September 30th of this year, I would encourage you all, to the extent you've got issues with CFTC's rules, either to contact us and we can submit comments. I think there are, Tom and I were talking about this earlier, there are some efforts on a more formal basis to potentially submit comments about the CFTC rules from the practitioners, New York State Bar Association and City Bar are thinking about doing this. As far as comments from my own perspective, I mentioned I do think that, you know, we do need harmonization and streamlining of the U.S. person definition that creates a lot of confusion. Simplifying Form PF and CPO PQR and, you know, in order to allow market participants to not spend so much time and effort and, frankly, legal costs on compliance. The other two things that I want to talk about very quickly, the second is listed on the slide here, Lab CFTC. Unclear if this is really going to take off or it's this is something the CFTC apparently is doing to keep themselves busy. I think they're, if you guys are familiar at all with the emerging technologies for clearance and settlement, I think this is based off of the idea that we want to move to a more streamlined system for clearance and settlement. They're included this Lab CFTC as a project or an initiative out on their website, and it's to encourage market participants to innovate in that space, to submit ideas directly to the CFTC in order to streamline and the markets and the efficiency thereof. And we're almost out of time, but I did want to briefly talk about, and we've mentioned it a number of times today, so that's actually HR 10, HR 5983 was last year, but the Financial Choice Act, it is going to make a difference potentially for this audience, and it, you know, we've already talked about the repeal of the Volcker Rule. There are some significant changes which would, although Chris Cox did mention it doesn't repeal Title VII, which is a title for derivatives under Dodd-Frank, it is going to make a number of changes, which hopefully I think will be beneficial to the buy side market. And you know, particularly as Chris mentioned before, Section 871, which is going to hopefully allow the agencies, the SEC and the CFTC, to harmonize the rules. And I think we're out of time. We have a short break scheduled right after this. So thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.